Welcome aboard, ladies and gentlemen. It is Tuesday night, the 25th of May. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you live from Washington, D.C. here this Tuesday night. Washington, D.C., the headquarters of American Free Press and the Barnes Review. Now, if you are a reader of the Barnes Review at this time, the Barnes Review website, of course, is barnesreview.com or barnesreview.org, you are going to be familiar with the very special guest we have here this evening. His name and some of his work was featured quite prominently in a recent edition, in fact, the most recent edition of the Barnes Review, dedicated around the theme of Willis Cardo's signatory essay, The Revenge of the Neanderthal. Now, when I mentioned that essay by Willis Cardo on this program in announcing the publication of that issue of the Barnes Review, there were actually a few people who thought we were joking, that there was some sort of crazy sense of humor on the part of Willis or on my part or the part of the people with the Barnes Review about suggesting that many, if not all, of the modern-day folks who are known today as Jews might be descendants of the famous Neanderthals. I recall getting an email from someone who thought the show was amusing. He thought this was supposed to be a joke, or that this was some sort of clever, if not maybe offensive, way of finding a new defamatory term for Jews. No, not at all. Not at all. And in fact, as I mentioned to you in talking about this even further on this program, Willis Cardo had first mentioned to me some years ago, I would say probably right back in the early 90s. Not quite sure when, folks, but it was in the early to mid-90s. Willis Cardo mentioned to me that he had been keeping a file for a long, long time on the subject of the Neanderthals. And it was his feeling, just this gut feeling, from reading a lot of literature, a lot of historical things, a lot of archaeological studies of various kinds. Willis is no expert on any of these subjects, but he's a reader and researcher. He had come to the conclusion, without having any real scientific proof, of course, he had come to the conclusion that the difference between Jews and non-Jews, and this is something that Jewish folks write about all the time in their own writings, in their own newspapers. In fact, I think there was a book entitled Jews Are Different. Well, Willis Cardo had come to the conclusion that maybe that difference could be traced to ancient times, and that perhaps it might have something to do with the Jews being of at least partial descent from the Neanderthals. Well, you know, I started looking that up on the Internet. I typed in the word Jews and the word Neanderthals, and all of a sudden I discovered that there were two writers, but one writer in particular who had distinguished himself on this subject and had actually written a book about it. And the book had caused quite a stir, and ultimately there were some serious efforts to silence this author and to make his book disappear. Well, that author of that book is Michael Bradley. And Michael Bradley is going to join us here this evening, very shortly after the break, and talk about his experiences in this very controversial arena, and about some new evidence that just basically confirms things that he wrote, well, quite a few years ago. And as I say, Willis Cardo was delighted to learn of the existence of Michael Bradley and his work, and I'm very pleased to have Michael Bradley with us here this evening. So stay tuned, folks. You may be surprised, you may be shocked, but I think you're going to learn something. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. We are here this evening with a very special guest, Michael Bradley. And I am going to ask you to get your pen and paper handy, folks, because we're going to have Mr. Bradley give you the relevant information on this program, where you can contact him, where you can order his writings, where you can read his writings, and do all those things that I know you're going to want to do after you have talked to Michael Bradley. Now, I just want to go ahead and welcome Michael Bradley. Michael, welcome aboard.
Sure.
Michael, I think I hear you, but we might have a bad...
Hi there, Michael Collins Piper.
There you go.
Me?
Okay, I thought we were connected. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, we are.
You know, the first time I heard about you was so long ago. It was long before I had this radio program, which I've only had for 4 years. So I was just thinking it's kind of funny. I would have never expected to be interviewing you on the radio, but here we are, and I do welcome you aboard.
Well, my first book on the subject was written, if I can add, 32 years ago and was published in November 1978.
Okay.
And it was called The Iceman Inheritance. And I'm not surprised that you don't really remember it. And my second book on the subject was Chosen People from the Caucasus, published in Chicago by Third World Press in 1991. That was a long time ago, too. And the interesting thing is that the newest article in Science Magazine, which was May 6th, 2010, verifies what I wrote in both books.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
yeah, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of interesting, Michael. When I first came across your website, and by the way, I want you to give that website information out later here in the program. I think you heard me mention that. You know, I was amazed at the stories you related on your website about the very long and tangled history of your book, The Iceman Inheritance. I mean, this is a book that initially was greeted with a lot of interest, but then suddenly this iron curtain of censorship came down around it. If you could, I think our listeners would be interested in hearing about that.
Well, that may be true. In 1978, when it first came out, it was excerpted by at least three major Canadian dailies in Canada, where I live, and articles about it were written in at least 20 major U.S. daily newspapers. I don't have them all. But then a curtain came down. My book was supposed to be reprinted by Warner Publishing Company, that's AOL Warner, arguably the largest publisher in the world. But they ceased and desisted from putting out their mass-market paperback edition because of all their stores got threatened and firebombed. I did, too. I got threatened. And some of my university lectures were canceled. I was almost stabbed on the podium of Kennedy King College in Chicago, where I was speaking at that time. And subsequently, a lot of people, organizers, would not do my lectures because they could not guarantee my safety.
Well, this is a classic case of suppression. I mean, no doubt about it. I was surprised. Well, I shouldn't say surprised, but I was very much intrigued, I suppose, by reading your account on your website of all these things that had been done to you, and the very fact that the Time Warner books were going to put that out in a paperback. I mean, anybody who is familiar with the old spiral revolving book racks that appeared in drug stores and supermarkets around the country will remember that Time Warner Books practically dominated that. So obviously you had a major publishing company was going to put your works out there before millions of people, and then suddenly they withdrew.
Okay, Michael, I'd like to say something. They withdrew, okay, but they did put a paperback edition out before they withdrew.
Okay.
And I wish I could find a copy of it. They sold 40,000 copies.
Interesting. Okay.
Of The Iceman and Harrison's in 2 weeks.
Interesting.
In the New York City chess market, and then withdrew it. And I used to have a couple of copies of that paperback, and now I don't have one.
Well, the very fact, you know, right there, that fact that you just presented to us right there makes it all the more interesting and all the more suspicious and intriguing, because if they've sold 40,000 copies just within in the New York City test area...
In two weeks.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
In two weeks,
obviously they had a moneymaker on their hands, but there was some motivation that led them to decide that they were not going to make money. Now, that's where your writings become so controversial, and I think we have about 3 minutes before the first break. If you could just kind of just tell us what you determined and what you were writing about.
Well, what I was writing about was this originally... I want to underline, if I can, on radio, the original way.
Mm-hmm.
The aggression of the white race. Now, this was jumped on by the Afrocentrists, naturally, and by a lot of liberals. And the reason I stuck to that in The Iceman and Harrison's 1978... was because at that time there was no evidence and no hints even to suggest where the center of this aggression came from. Now there is, and between 1978 and 1991, the evidence came out as to where the center of this aggression was. And then I wrote chosen people from the Caucasus, suggesting that there was interbreeding between the Neanderthals, who are highly aggressive. I'd like to cite a scientific thing here, which was the study called Hard Times Among the Neanderthals by Dr. Eric Trinkaus and Dr. T. Dale Stewart, which said that basically the Neanderthals had twice as many fractures, injuries, and whatever to their fossil bones compared to the any similar number of fossil bones from any other fossil human population. So then I began to be able to pinpoint where this aggression in Western man, and by that I don't mean Western Europeans, but from Western Asia to the Atlantic coast of Europe, came from. And it was the Caucasus Mountains of the Middle East, and the Middle East, and especially the highlands of the Middle East, because the Neanderthals were basically a highland species. They stuck to the mountaintops and highlands originally. And so that's where this aggression really came from. But until 1981, I couldn't say anything more than the, quote, white race, unquote, which got me in trouble. It made me the darling, you might say, of the Afrocentrists, but it didn't make me the darling of the right-wing white nationalists, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, whatever you want to call them. They didn't like that at all. So, but by 1991, enough data had come out to pinpoint the genetic source of this aggression, and the Science article, which just came out 3 weeks ago, on May 6, 2010, verifies that.
Yeah, well, that's a vindication long time coming. And ironically, of course, and we are going to the break here in a moment, ironically, that Science article just happened to come out the very week that the Barnes Review had just gone to press, focusing on Willis Cardo's essay, which, of course, we published excerpts alongside it from some of the things that you had written. So when we come back, we'll talk about that Science article. We're going to the break, folks. We're here with Michael Bradley. Get your pen and paper handy. Mr. Bradley's going to tell you where you can get in touch with him and read more of his writings and get his books. Stay tuned. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here with our very special guest, Michael Bradley. You know, for years, as long as I can remember, I was always told growing up that, well, we're all alike. Everybody on the entire planet is absolutely alike. We just go to different churches, or we have different religions, or our skin color is different. But really, we are all one in the same. Well, I never quite believed that, but I was always told that's what was the thing we were supposed to believe. But our guest here this evening essentially challenged that thesis a long, long time ago, and his vindication has been a long, long time coming, and the controversy continues. So, Michael Bradley, we left off talking about the May 6th, 2010 edition of Science Magazine.
Yes, we did. And that was very important, although it was still statistically disguised, you might say. The May 6, 2010 article finally admitted in the pages of Science, and I'm sure you've seen this because I saw it, on ABC News and also up here in Canada on CBC, I think, that, quote, 1 to 4% of Neanderthal of all the human DNA in the world, except for Africa, where there's no Neanderthal DNA, supposedly, is Neanderthal. Now, the problem with that is, this is a statistical game here. The May 6, 2010 Science study concedes that the area of interbreeding between Neanderthals and so-called Cro-Magnons, or the preferred term now is early modern humans, took place in the Caucasus Middle East, and therefore one would expect a distribution of Neanderthal DNA to be something like this, that in the Middle East, and especially the Caucasus Middle East, it'd be pretty high, and then it would taper off very quickly from then, east to west of the Caucasus Mountains, west to Atlantic Europe, there would be probably none, north to the Baltic, there'd probably be no Neanderthal DNA, and in the Pacific Far East, to be known in your soul DNA. And in Africa, we've already been told by the study, there is no Neanderthal DNA. Right. Given all that, and given the population of the Middle East, the conclusion is that all this Neanderthal DNA must be concentrated in the Caucasus Mountains of the Middle East. And as I said before, in the highlands and mountainous areas of the Middle East, let us say, the Caucasus Mountains themselves, the Taurus Mountains of Turkey, the Elburz Mountains of Iran, the Hindu Kush of Afghanistan, and the Pamirs of Pakistan. Okay, so there we have it. Now, a co-worker of the new study, 2010 study, Dr. Johannes Krause, K-R-A-U-S-E, stated to the mid-German television network on May 10th, 2010, that the Neanderthal composition of some groups in the Middle East, that is to say the Semitic groups there, Jews, Arabs, Armenians, whatnot, was from, quote, 10 to 20% at least Neanderthal. Now, this links to the mid-German TV network was deactivated on May 18th, so it was on for 8 days, basically.
Another one of those disappearing facts.
That's right. Okay, so what we have here is that the Semitic people from the Middle East are highly Neanderthal. Now, my own calculations indicate that 10 to 20% is sort of a minimum. I think it's more like 50% in some areas, and in some small pockets of the Middle East. Remember, the mountain valleys there are small in the Caucasus, Middle East. And there's a huge...
Michael, hold that thought. We're going to our mid-hour break, and then we're going to have a 25-minute stretch after that. Stay tuned,
okay,
folks. We're here with Michael Bradley. Very interesting historical and scientific findings that really do help explain a lot of the problems in the Middle East and the world today. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. 30 years ago, roughly, more than 30 years ago, Michael Bradley started exploring the area that we're talking about here tonight, and since that time, in fact, just within the last several years, there's been a lot of scientific research, revolutionary findings that have confirmed what Michael Bradley was saying, and he's here talking about it with us tonight, specifically the fact that Neanderthals did, in fact, interbreed with what we now call early modern man, and that there is a heavy Neanderthal genetic presence among people in our world today, particularly in the Middle East. So, Mr. Bradley, if you would continue.
That my website address, I think it's called, is www.michaelbradley.info. Now, the very first article on that website deals with the science issue of May 6, 2010, and Johannes Krauss's statements to the Mid-German TV network on May 10th, 2010, and how it was cut off on May 18th, 2010. Now, the whole point of this story, I suppose, is that we've got to understand the implications of what this means. Way back in 1978, 1 month after my Iceman Inheritance was published in November of 1978, Dr. Eric Trinkaus, most world expert on Neanderthals, and T. Dale Stewart of the Smithsonian Institute wrote an article for a journal called Natural History Magazine. And this is a journal of the American Museum of Natural History in New York. Not a very radical organization. And their article was called Hard Times Among the Neanderthals. Now, they subjected every single bone that was then known of Neanderthals, which is less than now, to a forensic analysis, and they found that there were more than twice as many injuries among these Neanderthal bones as among any similar accumulation of bones from any fossil human population. So what we have going for us is that the Neanderthals are about twice as aggressive as we are. That is to say, everybody else. And by everybody else, I mean Western Europeans, Far Eastern Asians, American Indians, South American Indians, you name it. These people have driven a wedge between the ordinary humanity of, say, Western Europe and Eastern China. And it may or may not be human. And the reason for this is that the same area that nurtured the Neanderthals previously apparently nurtured the Homo habilis creature, whatever it was. This has been found in Georgia and the Caucasus since 1991. It's made a big splash in the Georgian press. They've enthusiastically dubbed it Homo georgicus. But there is no difference between Homo georgicus and the aforementioned Homo habilis of former East Africa. Now, when I was writing way back when, in 1978 and 1991, nobody ever imagined that Homo habilis would be found in the Caucasus Mountains. But I was canny enough to say in the Iceman Inheritance that the Neanderthals must have had some ancestor of some sort who did not come from the Far East, who did not come from Europe, who may have come from Africa, but a long time ago. We're talking 3 million years here. And sure enough, Homo habilis was found in the Northern Caucasus by Dr. David, I can't pronounce his name, Lordepanitsi, I think, of the Georgian Academy of Sciences. And you can read about it in National Geographic, August, I think, 2002. But in any case, you can find it on the Internet. Now, what does this mean? It means that the Neanderthals of the Middle East may not be quite human, as we rather loosely define that term. Neanderthal anthropology has already shown that they are about twice as aggressive as we are, but the fact of the matter is their ancestors may not have been quite human, and do not share the same sort of mentality we do. They are characterized by various physical things, traits, of which very great nasal development, long torsos, short legs, extreme male hairiness, are the physical characteristics. But more important than that, the peoples of the Middle East are characterized by extreme anti-feminism and a extreme monotheism. And an intolerance for any difference. It's like between races or sexes. So there's a great deal of violence there. Now, nobody has to dispute this very much, because most of our enemies in Iraq and Iran have done most damage by suicide bombers. You can't be a suicide bomber unless you're utterly convinced of your rightness in the cause and your utter, and I mean utter, dedication to the idea of monotheism. And we all know about the anti-feminism in Afghanistan and even in Israel, if I can say that, because they're all the same. And some Israeli conservative newspapers, they're not even allowed to print images of women. Now, we have a problem here, that we're not fighting a political or religious war in the Middle East. We are fighting a genetic war in the Middle East. And anybody who doesn't understand that better go back to school. But what? I don't know which school they'll go to, because most of the schools are, as the ones you went to, Michael, dominated by people say, oh, we're all the same, we're all the same, we're all the same. There's one big happy family, right? Wrong. We're facing, in the Middle East, a group of people who have driven a wedge, in essence, from the lakes of Africa 3 million years ago, between the ordinary humans of the far west and the ordinary humans of the far east. Now, nobody may like Orientals very much, but we all have one thing in common. We all have A, tendency toward polytheism. B, a great deal of artistic visual ability. We all tolerate females in society and in the divine scheme of things. The Middle Easterners don't tolerate any of those things, and they have no artistic ability to speak of in a visual sense. They are highly intelligent in terms of numbers and spatial intelligence. And that's the major cause of the world's problems from 5600 B.C. to the present. We may think all this is new in the Middle East, but Jesus, pardon me, it's been going on since 3500 B.C., at least in recorded form, and from 5600 B.C., according to archaeological data, and actual archaeological finds in the earth that have been dated. I need a break.
Michael, one thing I know a lot of our listeners are interested in, and you have written on this, is the Khazar connection to all of this. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that.
I'll talk a little bit about it. Khazars were people who lived on the Caucasus steppes of Ukraine, roughly 740 A.D., and they had a choice. They were primitive, and they were male dominant, they were extremists and all that kind of stuff, and they had a choice. Are you going to convert to Christianity, which was imposing upon them from the Byzantine Empire, or are you going to convert to Islam, which was imposing upon them from the Iranian invasion of Iran by Arabs? They chose neither route. They adopted Judaism because it was a respectable religion. They were people of the book, and so the Khazars converted to Judaism. Now, historians quibble over how many of these 3 or 5 million Khazars on the Ukrainian steppes converted to Judaism. Some say all of them did, because the king said, do it or else. And some say not many did, because they didn't care what the king said. But you can take your pick. Now, in 1238, the Mongols, give or take, I say 1238, give or take a few years, the Mongols, under a brilliant general called Baku of the Golden Horde, invaded the Ukraine and therefore pushed the Khazars into modern Poland, half of Germany, the eastern half, roughly. And that's where our Jews of the Warsaw Ghetto and whatnot come from, because they came from the Ukrainian steppes of Russia and the South Russian steppes, and probably, I don't know where, but they had maybe sprinkled off by traitors by then, but by roughly 1238, the Mongols shoved them in to, Central Europe, Poland, half of Germany. Now, there was a difference between the Mongol invasions and other ones. The Mongols didn't care very much about imposing their religion, they had none, on anybody. All they wanted was more room to raise horses, cows, sheep, and whatever on the steppes. This was because of a temporary population expansion on the eastern Eurasian steppes in Kazakhstan. When that expansion stopped, Mongols dwindled back into the aforementioned Kazakhstan, where they are now. So they didn't conquer any bay to impose anything on them. Rather the reverse, they wanted to wipe them out so that the steppes were free for grazing. You understand? Rather a sensible idea, but the whole point of this is that the Mongols haven't conducted warfare like we do, which is to impose a religion and ultimately a Judaic religion on people.
All right, Michael, we're going to our last break here. When we come back, we'll wrap this up. And I'd like to ask you if you could come back here tomorrow night so we could pursue this further. And we have quite a few callers that would like to talk to you, and maybe we can get them in tomorrow night. So we are going to the break, folks. We'll wrap up this hour here in a few minutes. And if Mr. Bradley can come back tomorrow night, that would be fantastic. Anyway, stay tuned, folks.
Attention all business owners. Save up to 20% free of charge on your business.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here. It's hard to believe this hour has gone by as fast as it has, and it's been a fascinating hour. Michael Bradley, could you join us again here tomorrow night?
Sure.
All right, that would be fantastic. So we'll count on you joining us here tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Central Time. In the meantime, I know we had some callers who wanted to talk to you, and I'm sure they'll join us tomorrow night. But in the meantime, we have about 3 or 4 minutes here. If you could just kind of wind it up for the benefit of our listeners and just kind of put this all in perspective as to where we are now in our modern day.
I wish I knew, but I can direct your listeners to my website. The first article on it, after all the introductory junk about welcome to the official Lomsai server, www.michaelbradley.info. Now, this whole Science May 6, 2010 article has inspired me, given the economic meltdown, the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, the pollution of the Gulf of Mexico, and God only knows what else is coming, to form a movement, I hope, against this Neanderthal Semitic influence in world societies, not just ours, but Japanese, Chinese, everybody's society. Remember, it was mostly Jewish advice that made Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR, nuke Japan at the end of World War II, and Truman, as a lame duck president then, faithfully followed this advice, but the advice was given by the two Henry Morgenthals and Bernard Baruch. Henry Morgenthal Sr. Was head of a Near Eastern Relief Fund, a thinly disguised organization for establishing Israel, and Henry Morgenthal Jr. was head of the Treasury since 1935. Bernard Baruch was a Wall Street financier. They were Roosevelt's, FDR's, three primary advisors, and they advised him to nuke Japan with the help of Hollywood, who said that the Japanese were prone to inhuman resistance when more oriental conflicts had been settled by negotiation than Western ones. Reeves, Svyatoslava, The Game of Foxes by Ladislav Vorogel. Now, the whole point of this is we've been played since forever, i.e. 3500 B.C., in terms of recorded history, but this game, and it has no rules, is totally ruthless, and this is because the Neanderthals have about twice as much aggression as we do.
Well, I tell you what, I can't think of a better point to close off this conversation here this evening, and we will begin with it again here tomorrow night. Michael Bradley, the music is playing, but once that music starts up tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Central Time, we will continue this discussion. It's been a pleasure to have you aboard, and I look forward to talking with you further tomorrow night. We'll get some callers in. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It is Wednesday, the 26th of May. This is Michael Collins Piper coming to you from Washington, D.C., headquarters of American Free Press. Check out the website of American Free Press at AmericanFreePress.net and the headquarters of the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly historical magazine. The website for the Barnes Review is BarnesReview.com and also BarnesReview.org. Anyway, folks, this broadcast tonight is a continuation of last night's broadcast. If you didn't hear it, I would encourage you certainly to listen to it in the archives here at RBN. But I have to say this, that I think probably last night's broadcast was one of the most historically profound broadcasts that I've done in the four or so years that I've been broadcasting here on RBN, because our guest last night, and he will join us again here tonight very shortly, is Michael Bradley. Now, Michael Bradley caused quite a stir in some circles as far back as 1978 by writing a book entitled The Iceman Inheritance that was made to disappear despite the fact that it had sold well. It was made to disappear, and his book made the assertion that certain elements in modern society today could trace their heritage back to the famous Neanderthals. Now, I first heard of Michael Bradley some years ago on the internet, for those of you who are tuning in for the first time tonight, and I hope there are some new listeners tuning in. I first heard of Michael Bradley when I started doing some research on the Neanderthals, specifically on the question as to whether the modern-day folks we know of generally, and they are very mixed people indeed, the modern-day folks we know of as the Jews may have had some connection to the Neanderthals. And the reason why I was researching this is because my longtime colleague and publisher, Willis Cardo, at the Barnes Review, had mentioned to me, I guess sometime in the early 1990s, that he had developed a theory based on his own reading and research over the years that perhaps, indeed, Jewish folks of today were remnants of the famous and ancient Neanderthals. Now, you know, as Mr. Cardo explained his thesis to me, and he showed me his little file on the subject, I'm no scientist by any means, but, you know, it made sense to me. So I thought, finally, when the Internet came around, I thought, you know, I'm going to look around and see if there might be anything anywhere that would point in this direction. And lo and behold, here were the works of Michael Bradley. And Michael Bradley's website, which he will refer you to again here tonight, very interesting website because it it tells a lot about what has happened to Michael Bradley as a consequence of his research into this controversial area. And he's the pioneer. He's been doing this. He's been doing it since 1978. And just totally by coincidence, a few weeks ago, the Barnes Review, published by Willis Cardo, issued a special edition of the Barnes Review, which I was the editor of. I don't normally edit those issues of the Barnes Review, but I sat in as the editor on this one at Mr. Cardo's request. It was framed around the thesis, Revenge of the Neanderthal. Quite a bit of material in there framed around a essay by Willis Cardo, but we also, of course, did mention quite prominently the work of Michael Bradley. And lo and behold, some big scientific publications have now confirmed what Michael Bradley's been saying for years, and we are going to bring Michael Bradley back tonight, and you will have the opportunity to talk to him. So if you have some questions about what we've already discussed, now's the time to call in, folks. 800-313-9443. That's
here. Heart-related health
problems. All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here with our special guest again tonight, Michael Bradley. If you want to call in here with some questions for Mr. Bradley, the number is 800-313-9443, 800-313-9443. Okay, well, Michael Bradley, I want to welcome you aboard again and thank you for taking your time to make time two nights in a row to be with us here. So welcome aboard.
Hello, Michael. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, Michael, you know, something we didn't mention last night on the program, and it's really, you know, it's funny, it's actually irrelevant. But due to the politically correct nature of so many people, I think we probably should mention it just to rock their world. You happen to be of Jewish extraction yourself, do you not?
More or less, if you can believe my mother, but that's a usually unreliable source. So I wouldn't count on that if I were you.
Okay.
Anybody else, but yes. I'm supposed to be half-Jewish.
Okay.
But
well, the reason why I bring that up...
I'm half-Cherokee, too.
Well, my God, I'm part Indian myself, but I don't know what tribe, so I always tell people I'm some sort of mutt. I'm Irish, Dutch, German, and American Indian. Well,
right.
Michael, the reason why I drag that out of you is because, you know, there's a... Even though the listeners to this network are very well-rounded people and very open-minded, a lot of times when you get into the discussion of things that touch on the conflicts in the Middle East and how that affects the U.S. policy here in Washington, D.C., people start getting a little nervous. Because,
I don't
you know,
blame them.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, we're bombarded every day with stories about the Nazis and Hitler and fascism and anti-Semitism and, oh, poor little Israel is going to be bombed off the face of the earth tomorrow. So people get very, very nervous about that. So then when you have a guest as controversial as you are, that really gets them nervous. So by telling them that you do happen to be part Jewish, that makes them feel a little better. I never quite understood the psychology there, but it makes people feel better. Well, you know, and I won't even try to explain it. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes, of course.
Anyway, that having been pushed out of the way, we left our conversation last night at the end of what I thought was a very interesting hour with you making the point, and this is a very significant point in the context of what our world faces today, that there is a very, how can I put this, there is a heavy weight of Neanderthal genes surviving today in the Middle East, and the Neanderthals were a very aggressive people. And
that's correct. Now,
this thing in the Middle East has captured the attention of the world. It's like the entire world is focused on what's going on in the Middle East. So I just wonder if you could continue with that.
Yeah, well, but first of all, Michael, I'd like to say that my website, www.michael.com Michael Bradley, B-R-A-D-L-E-Y, .info. I've just written over the last 3 or 4 days because of the science article on May 6th, 2010. Not all I really know about the Neanderthals and the implications of this study, but what people can get out of it. I didn't want to go into the various physical anthropological details, which very few people could follow or would be interested in, compared, say, to Britney Spears. So I've done what I could there. And it goes some 16 pages, and it says what I have to say.
Now, your books are out of print at this time. I mean, there's no publishing house that has your books in print. Is that correct?
That is correct, but it may be that Barnes Review Book Club will put them back into circulation.
Okay, well, that's good. I hadn't heard any discussion of that, but I'm not privy to everything that goes on there, so I'm glad to hear that. That's good news. I certainly would have recommended that myself, but I wanted to find out from you if people could obtain copies of your books from you at this time, because I think there'd be a lot of people who would be interested. Do you have any copies available at all?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
They're published on CD-ROM.
Okay.
By JBL e-publishing on my website. Again, www.michaelbradley.info. And people can order the CD-ROMs of my books, both The Iceman Inheritance and others.
Okay.
And they can get the original copy of Chosen People from the Caucasus on the same website.
Okay, great.
They just have to push PayPal, you know?
Yeah, I had seen that, you know, several weeks ago, but, you know, time changes things, and I didn't know if they were still available. Well, that's good, because I know there's a lot of people who would actually be interested in reading the entirety of what you've written. But that's good, because, and as I say, I'm going to certainly encourage the Barnes Review myself to put your books out in paperback form, because, you know, in this day and age, everybody thinks the Internet is the last best thing, but I'm not so sure about that. I still like to hold a book between my hands, you know.
Sure, and you don't need any electronic devices between you and the trees when you're in the park.
There we go. Well, I tell you what, we have a couple callers already lined up here, and I expect we'll have some more. So why don't we just go right to the callers? These guys, I know at least one of them is a regular listener, so
sure.
We'll go right to this caller, and then we have a break coming up, so we'll just have about enough time for him to fire away with his question. We're going to Chicago with Steve. Steve, welcome aboard.
Yes, I found it interesting Mr. Bradley was talking about the Jews in relation to Afghanistan, but isn't this actually like the fourth Anglo-Afghan war that we went through? And what is the relationship between the Jewish people and the British?
Pardon me? I know I heard your question, but I'm not sure it makes any sense, at least to me. Okay, the Afghan war we're into because supposedly the 9/11 tragedy was planned and done in Afghanistan by the Taliban under the elusive and possibly non-existent Osama bin Laden. Now, I don't know what that has to do with the British people, which is what your question was. So I can't answer you, really. I just don't know.
Okay. Well,
Steve, let me ask you a question just to clarify. Were you talking about the political connections, or were you talking about some kind of historical or genetic connection?
Historical genetic connection.
Okay, I couldn't answer that, and I don't know if Michael can answer that either. That's what I wanted to clarify, though.
I do know that the Youngblood expedition into Afghanistan, I believe, 1879, there's a plaque there in the middle of Khyber Pass. 10,000 British went in, and one came out, so he could tell all the others what happened to the other 9,999. Now, I believe that if we're not careful, the same thing is going to happen with us. But, of course, we're better than the British were in 1879, just like we're better than the Soviets were in 1988 or whenever the hell it was. And now them came out either.
Well, it's a strange coincidence that we're back fighting or going to fight Iran, which the Brits were doing, and their history with Bomber Harris of bombing the Iraqis, the Kurds, and the Iranians during the 1920s. Now we're in Afghanistan, too. It looks like a continuation of British hegemony and supremacy and imperialism.
It may be. I don't know. I only know what I know, and that's very limited. And I put that all on my website, the very first article, and I can't claim to be an historian. I was trained in zoology, then went to anthropology, and I know what I know, if you know what I mean. But, as a pop song of several years ago said, but nothing else. I'm afraid I can't really help you with your question, sir.
Okay, thank you very much.
Steve, thanks for your call. Yeah, hey, Michael, actually, I do have a question for you. I'm not sure, you know, I have read... I haven't read the whole book, but I have read parts of The Iceman Inheritance. I actually have a copy around here that Willis Cardo obtained, an old edition. It was printed by an Afrocentric publishing company in New York. Oops, I hear the break coming up. Michael, hang on there. I have a question for you when we come back. All right, folks, we have Michael Bradley with us. Check out that website at michaelbradley.info. Fascinating information. michaelbradley.info.
Do you know the truth about cancer treatments?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Try it again. Welcome back. This is Michael Collins Piper here. We have a very special guest here tonight, two nights in a row here now, Michael Bradley, and his website is michaelbradley.info, and his name is spelled MichaelBradley, just like it sounds, michaelbradley.info, and that's I-N-F-O, as in short for information. Now, Michael, I have a real quick question here. This is probably very parochial. It's kind of a one writer to another question. I've written a few books and thousands of articles, and in the case of the books, I can usually pinpoint one thing or another that inspired me to start writing the book or researching the book. If I could take you back to the mid-1970s, and of course your book, The Iceman Inheritance, came out in 1978, is there any one particular thing that sparked your interest or sparked your research that led to this basically more than 30 years of writing and research on the topic of the Neanderthal?
Had read Carlson Coon's The Origin of Races, and I looked him up and phoned him. He lived in Massachusetts then. I think he's dead now. And I talked to him. And then Carlton Kuhn, who was professor emeritus of anthropology at the University of Pennsylvania, was so interested in this conversation that he came up to Toronto, actually, and then I later went down to Massachusetts and went through a two-year crash course, you might say, in Neanderthal anthropology, because I disagreed with some things Carlton Kuhn had said, but I think he got it more right than anyone else at the time. So what I did was I learned from him as much as I could. I held, handled, measured, whatever, Neanderthal skulls, Neanderthal bones that were known then, and could see the evolution of this. Now, I'd like to say one other thing. That put me on to the fact that the epicenter, the nexus, the center of Western white man's aggression in the world, which a lot of races would attest to, was actually not coming from Western Europe or Central Europe so much. It's coming from the Middle East. And as the Middle Eastern people infiltrated the peoples of the West, then we got more aggressive. But the epicenter was in the Caucasus Middle East. Now, this took a long, long time, I guess. Gee, I don't know, 10 years or so. And then I wrote Chosen People from the Caucasus, where I thought the epicenter of this highly aggressive, highly monotheistic, highly anti-feminist mindset, there's no way of putting it, came from. So that explains the two books.
You know, I'm so glad I asked you that question for a reason which, again, is very personal here. A friend of mine who has been a longtime reader of the Barnes Review has been very, very enthusiastic about this particular issue that features your work and Willis Cardo's essay and all this accompanying material. And it's very, very interesting because this gentleman I'm referring to has been a longtime enthusiast likewise of Carlton Kuhn. So when I report to him that you had that personal relationship, that collaboration, so to speak, with Carlton Kuhn, he's going to really be delighted to hear that. So glad I asked you that question. Very
interesting. Carlton Kuhn wrote me a letter once after I had submitted to him the manuscript of The X-Man Inheritance. He wrote back, "Michael, we'll grill together." And I rather like that, you know. And
that word grill, interesting word choice there.
It was, yeah. We'll all grill together, you know. And so that's basically what happened to me.
Okay. Well, that's a very interesting genesis, for want of a better word of putting it.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I tell you what, Michael, we have a couple other callers lined up here, but we are rolling fast into our half-hour break. But when we come back, we will bring up Ed from California, who has a question for our guest, Michael Bradley. In the meantime, during the break, while you're listening to our sponsors, you might want to go to Michael Bradley's website at michaelbradley.info, and that may inspire a question or two from one of you out there in the listening audience. So check it out, michaelbradley.info. Stay tuned, folks. Interesting conversation with a very interesting fellow. Stay tuned.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, assuming you are all ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Michael Collins Piper here. We have our special guest, Michael Bradley, and we have some callers lined up with questions. And our first caller is, I guess, Ed in Florida. Did I get that right? Ed in Florida.
Yes, you did, Michael. This is an honor. I just finished your book, The Judas Goats, and I'm telling you, it's the best book I've ever read. For all your listeners who haven't purchased it yet, go out and get a copy.
Oh, I like those commercials. I appreciate that, Ed.
Now, my question to your guest is, a couple of years ago, it might have been either the Nova Channel or the Discovery Channel, came up with a two-hour docudrama about the Paleo Clovis Man and how they were saying they may have been European in origin. I just want to know if that's true or not. And if it is true, why is it not in the high school and middle school grade textbooks?
Hello?
Yeah, Michael? Yeah.
Yeah, are you talking about a documentary called The Journey of Man?
I think it might have been called something like 10,000 B.C. or something like that. It came out about a year and a half ago.
Okay, well, I don't know that one, but I do know The Journey of Man, which had an immense amount of money behind it, and we're trying to convince us all that modern humans had come out of Africa about 15,000 B.C.
Okay.
And they managed to go through a whole 2 hours of it without ever mentioning the N-word, Neanderthal, and everybody's cousin and brother were all one big happy family, and that was the whole idea of the show.
And I think this one basically assumed that a lot of these people came from Siberia.
In terms of production values, must have cost a fortune, and they had a California surfer type, blonde-haired sociologist doing all this for us, and it was all total disinformation.
Now, there must be some sort of political agenda behind that. In your opinion, why do you think they're not telling the truth?
Well, there was a political agenda behind that. And it's the political agenda that you talk about on our website, because the idea has to be that we're all one big happy family and one species, because if we're not, the Jews and Semites from the Middle East are the odd man out in the woodpile.
Because I was taught 35 years ago in school, earlier civilizations were in Mesopotamia, the city of Ur, but that's not taught anymore.
Well, no, it's not. Because basically the work of one woman, Maria Jambusis, of the University of Southern California, who has written several books, well, she's written 20, which has finally, given the evidence that there was a civilization in Europe. We don't know where it came from, except that the first exponents of the civilization seems to have come from somewhere out in the Atlantic. Now, Maria Jambudis's works, including the 1991, I think it was her last book, but I'm not sure, The Civilization of the Goddess, gives a great deal of evidence for this civilization, including alphabets of continental Europe and the Mediterranean islands. I try to cover this all on my website in the first 16, 17 pages, if they were translating the word, but it's very dull and uninteresting stuff for anybody who doesn't want information. I put in some illustrations to try to break up the text, but basically speaking, I've said what I have to say on that. And what we have going for us then is it was an old European civilization between 11,500 B.C., which is the accepted date now, more or less, for the end of the last ice age, till about 2,000, 1,000 B.C.
That could possibly jump, let's say, 8 or 9 millennia.
From anything in the Middle East.
Now, we're also being taught in the grade schools and high schools that, you know, Hannibal Barca was not European. He was pretty much African. The same thing with Cleopatra, who was a Ptolemy, and that she was a proud African woman as well. Now, how do you disagree with people who actually believe this as stone fact?
Well, I don't really. I mean, North Africa is a different kettle of fish from sub-Saharan Africa. Hamilcar Barca, that you quoted, was basically a Carthaginian.
Yes.
And Cleopatra the Seventh, I guess you're talking about, was a Ptolemy. She was a Greek. And that was because the Greeks conquered that part of North Africa around 330 B.C. And Cleopatra the Seventh was the daughter a long time afterwards of the general Ptolemy of Alexander's army that conquered North Africa. And that was mostly Caucasoid,
yes.
The native people there, and later they became much more influential, came up the Nile from Uganda, and so we have a very great racial mixture in North Africa, but not between Caucasoids and blacks only. But as Carlton Coon pointed out, the original people who were there were Capoids. Now, he likens them, gave that name, to what we call the modern Bushmen. They were not black, they were not white, they were sort of an apricot color, and they had an immense amount of intelligence in certain directions, not necessarily in others. And then the whites and the blacks came in on top of them.
Now, if I may ask you
a
question.
So we have Egypt.
If you look at a lot of the statuary of the Old Kingdom and perhaps the early, up until maybe the Middle Kingdom, they were almost Caucasian in feature, then it seems like maybe sometime after the fall of the Middle Kingdom or so, they just looked more Negroid in stature. Was it just a mixing of the races?
Well, that's because after of the old kingdom, which was about an ended when? Can we agree on this roughly?
2000 B.C., 1800?
Oh, no, 2500 B.C., give or take.
Okay.
Is that right?
Okay.
Okay. After that, there was an influx of Negroid people up the Nile from Uganda until about 1500 B.C., 1,000 years later.
Right.
We have more or less Negroid black people as the majority of the ancient Indian, ancient Egyptian population. So that's why the statuary changed.
Well, Doctor, I thank you very much. You've been very enlightening, sir.
Ed, I appreciate your call.
Thanks
a lot for calling and got some interesting information there. Okay, let's go up to Pennsylvania. We have Ron would like to talk to Michael Bradley. Ron, go ahead.
How are both Michaels doing this evening?
How are you doing tonight, Ron?
Oh, pretty good. I'll be very quick and rapid, as quick as I can, allow for other callers. For Michael Collins Piper, I want to thank you very much for the rapid sending of the New Babylon, which I'm still in progress of reading, and I thought it came as fast before the ink dried. Unbelievable.
All right, sounds good.
And I have a stack of AFP books here. A friend of mine passed on to me just before he passed away here several months ago. Very good. And I also have an email to send your way inquiring about a book that you didn't answer because of your volume of emails. But I'll be getting that out in a couple of days to you. But for Michael Bradley, I want to refresh my, this is from memory as best as I can. I remember reading an article in a mainstream, maybe weekly or monthly publication years ago, cannot recall, could be Time or Newsweek or some paper or some type of publication like that, which I don't read anymore. It had claimed that a new species of person or and something was archaeologically dug up, and the person that they found, they named the Neanderthal. Now, if you have to name something, that means it was hitherto undiscovered before, and it had to have a new moniker put on it. And oftentimes, naming something comes from the area where it is found or some other significant thing. Now, this was supposed to have been named, this man they found, after the Neanderthaler Valley, or the plains of France, which isn't anywhere near the Caucasus Mountains. And I wondered if, Mr. Bradley, if you had recalled this, and why would the disparity be for two completely different locales of the early discovery of the Neanderthal?
Well, the first Neanderthal skeleton was actually found in the Neanderthal, which means stream, valley of Germany, not France. And that was all very well. Like it was found in the 1850s. That is true. Now, during the last ice age, the Neanderthals who had developed in the Middle East had followed the highlands of the mountains and gradually migrated. There weren't very many of them, just a scattering, all over Western Europe. But there were many of them, and the skeleton we happened to find in the Neanderthal Valley, which gave the name Neanderthal to these people, was found in the 1850s. But since then, they've been found all over but Western Europe. But the vast, vast majority of them were not in Germany, France, or wherever, but are in the Middle East. And this changes almost every day. But some of them were also found in the mountains of the Balkans, at the Krapina Cave, say, in modern whatever, Slovenia, Croatia, I don't know. but they were mousing species. So we just happened to find the first specimen first in the Neanderthal Valley of Germany, not France. And that valley, by the way, was named after a pastor, Neander, who had changed his name to Greek, as was common then, and the tall just means a stream.
Well, I might throw this in here, Ron and Michael. In that issue of the Barnes Review that we just sent out, which references your work, it was reported that there, and we cited this from an article in the Washington Post, citing, I think it was Nature magazine or Science magazine, that there has in fact been now found this new form that is not Neanderthal and apparently is not Cro-Magnon. So I guess they're doing research on this right now. So this lends credence to the possibility even further that some other form emerged at some time in the distant past.
Absolutely. Are you referring to Woman X in the Siberian cave?
No, I don't think it was that one. This is one even more recently, I think, than that.
Really?
Yeah, there's. I don't have that information handy, but I mean, at the time they said that they said this was something that was absolutely revolutionary. A creature that had never been on the radar screens before.
And of course, this
indicates that there is so much more to be learned that we've never been told about.
That's right, because I'll tell you, about this time, say 100,000 BC to a million BC, there were all sorts of man-like creatures coming out of basically East Africa. I think that must have been pinned down, and migrating all over the world. And who knows where they went? I certainly don't.
Exactly. All right. Well, listen, Ron, I appreciate your call. We're going to a break here, and I want to try to squeeze in one more caller in the limited amount of time that we have. So if you all stay tuned, we will come back. We've got Martin calling from Washington. That'll be our last caller for the evening. And again, I urge you to check out the website of Michael Bradley at michaelbradley.info. Michaelbradley.info.
Did you ever wish that you could have done something while you still had the chance?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back. Unfortunately, we are wrapping up this hour, but I'm going to say to Michael Bradley that I'm going to send you an email the next couple days, Michael, and I'd like to get you back here next week sometime, and we can talk about the future, the political ramifications of what we've been talking about here, and what we can do about it. I think we've laid a good groundwork for that here. And we do have another caller, Martin from Washington. Martin, if you could keep your questions and comments very brief, that'll give Michael a chance to respond. Martin, go ahead.
I'll try to do that. You said something last night that really pricked my ears up, which was about fossils of Homo nilus being found in Europe. And I'm wondering, are you suggesting that Neanderthal, instead of, we've always been taught that they evolved from Homo erectus, that they evolved from Homo habilis?
Okay, Martin, is that your name?
Yes.
Thank you very much for asking that question. In the 1990s, which nobody suspected back in 1978 or even 1991, a skeleton, well, several skeletons were found in the Caucasus, the modern Republic of Georgia, which seemed to be Homo habilis. Now, the problem is they're about 3-4 million years old, 3 million years old, to 1.75 million years old, and the Neanderthals had to have some ancestors. So who were they, since they developed in the same area? Now, I've examined the casts of these skeletons found in the Caucasus called Homo habilis, but now the name's been changed to Homo georgicus, for some reason. And these bones were examined by Dr. David Lordipanizzi, whom I mentioned last night. Now, the problem is this. It's the molars of these jaws and the shape of these jaws. They are, in essence, very primitive Neanderthal jaws and molars, in that they have a tooth formula that is not exactly human. It's not exactly a Y5 cusp pattern. It's close, but not exactly. So what I think happened was that these Homo habilis, this is on my website too, under an article called Esau's Empire 1, A Homo habilis Subspecies of Mankind. These Homo habilis came up into the Caucasus of all places, and that they were possibly, I can't say for sure, the Neanderthal ancestors. But I can say that the only jaw, the type specimen jaw of Homo habilis, which is labeled mandible number 1600, is very long and thin and shows the same characteristics as later Neanderthal jaws, but a little bit more pronounced. The molars surviving from this jaw, which was found in 1960, are very much Neanderthal, because Neanderthals do not always have the human cusp pattern.
Michael, that's the end of the program. Sorry to cut you off. Thank you, Martin. Thanks. With